Welcome to Wild and Awake, an online retreat where you deepen your consciousness, arouse your courage, and choose with wisdom. We are exploring the question, how do I live my best life right now? I am your host, Kari Vantine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Wild and Awake. Today we have with us Lee True. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Thrilled to have you here. I'm going to jump in first with a little bit about your bio, and then we'll unroll from there.
Please.
Lee True is a psychotherapist and counselor who is passionate about cultural repair through building a culture of connection in families. Over 15 years in private practice, Lee developed rapport-based relating as an answer to the traditional shout and shame he saw in institutions working with children. His model breaks down the barriers for parents and teachers to have meaningful relationships with kids. Before training as a psychotherapist and counselor, Lee taught bushcraft and coyote mentoring on youth camps. He has been using John Young's coyote mentoring approach for over a decade. And we'll just also say some of you have maybe listened to John Young this past week as well. And Lee began learning and teaching bushcraft as a teenager at the 4 school camps in the UK. He studied Indigenous survival skills at Tom Brown's Junior's Tracking School and Practical Primitive in the US. He then studied a year living in the bush, finding shelter, water, and food in the landscape and putting it into practice. More than that, he found a radically new experience of what it means to be human. Now he brings psychology and bushcraft together for rewilding, helping people of all ages to awaken their wildness and deepen their connection with the natural world. And I love your bio. And I will also say that I've pulled a few things that weren't on your normal bio. And I just love to share because I think our audience will enjoy these extra little pieces, which is that you completed the Discovery Channel's Naked and Afraid 21-Day Challenge for anyone who watched that. This is Lee here. Exciting and fun. And it's just, you know, this is part of the challenge.
Yeah.
That you appeared on Channel 10's The Project, speaking on screen time and children. We may touch on that today a little bit. You were the one who supported Claire Dunn during the period she wrote about in her book, My Year Without Matches, which some of our audience knows about. And so we get to see this is the person referred to. And that's actually how I first discovered your work. And you acted as a consultant on bushcraft and trapping for the Australian film The Hunter, came out in about 2011. And I'd like to just say I love this Willem Dafoe, his quote, he played the title role, and his quote, he quoted, "Lee is at home in the wild. His grace and skill in survival, trapping, and bushcraft is remarkable. His love and respect for nature and his level of comfort in a wild environment is inspiring. He's also a gifted teacher. I'd want him in my tribe." That's a pretty good appreciation of you and your work, Lee.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Willem.
With all those things in place, we've kind of got this container that I'd like we're going to be playing in today. And there was a piece that we didn't mention, which is also that you've done incredible work with teaching children in your camps. And I hope that we'll get to that conversation as too, because a big part of your work is really teaching people how to be different, how to be more at home in nature, maybe not different nature, how to be more in nature. Where I'd love to start with is a term that I use in my work, and I know that you use in your work too, which is rewilding. And it is a word that I have really seen in the last couple of years has become part of our culture. People are using it more and more. And I think we're using it in similar ways, but different ways. I would love if you would to unpack what it means for you when you talk about rewilding and why that's actually important for people.
Yeah, thank you. I've gone on a real journey with this word. In the beginning, rewilding to me meant learning primitive survival skills, and that was what really drew me to Tom Brown School, and the idea of being at home in the wild, being able to meet my physical needs was just so inspiring. And then during that year in the bush, I started to realize I'd learned a lot of skills. I'd learned tracking, and I'd learned bow making, and I'd learned how to make fire and find food, and But there were lots of things about my modern body that weren't quite ready to be out in the wild, and not eating 3 square meals a day and tolerating extremes of heat and cold that, well, okay, yeah, actually, this is a big part of it too. So then that kind of deepened my appreciation of rewilding. There were some adaptations of just the physical body. And then about 3 months into that year, I was hit by this. Now I sort of understand it as a sort of kind of detox process, but I felt at the time like I was just going crazy. And I'd had enough psychological training. I'd started my psychotherapy diploma before I went into the bush. I had enough training to look at what was happening inside of me and think, this looks a little bit like that psychosis stuff they're talking about, where my mind seems to be falling apart. Crazy disjointed thoughts, and monkey mind is just spinning its wheels. I'm on this roller coaster of paranoia or grief or shame or rage or self-loathing and terror. And I, from one moment to the next, it's really hard to predict what the hell is going on inside of me. I feel like I'm falling apart. I've read about people having these lovely experiences in the bush. It seems so effortless. And there's much less grace at the moment, a lot more clunkiness and horror. And at the time, I thought I was just getting it wrong. But now, looking back, I see this was a rewilding process that was going on. This was a healing and a releasing of the things that weren't in alignment with this natural environment that I was in. And the solitude and the wild nature and my intent to go deeper and to rewild was catalyzing this process. One way of thinking about it now, I sort of think about the idea of undigested emotions, undigested thoughts. There were experiences that I'd had that were overwhelming or painful or sorrowful, and I hadn't had time to digest them in the human-made world where there were, you know, any number of distractions coming along all the time. And now it's like my nervous system my heart and soul and mind were saying, okay, here, thank God, here's an opportunity. And the Pandora's box opened and it all came pouring out. And I was sort of at the mercy of that for the middle 6 months of my year there. And in the final 3 months, I emerged into this place of silence and grace. Incredible synchronicities started to happen, incredible intuitive experiences. And that was the time I started noticing these things were going on and thinking, my God, I think this is what it's supposed to be like to be a human. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, yeah, you feel that.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, yeah. And then it was like, okay, now I just want to share this. Actually, I'd like other people to be able to have this. I don't think this is widely available at the moment. And now I'm called back into the world to see if I can help other people to on this journey. But always what hit me was the meeting of my physical needs to be at home in wild nature wasn't the hardest part. The hardest part was the internal processes, the emotional and psychological blocks, and the kind of spiritual detoxification that happened in that process. And that's sort of the framework that I approach my rewilding now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lee. That was really a beautiful unfolding. And I would say, yeah. I for the people who know and follow me, I grew up off the grid till I was 17. And then I went back and lived alone in a log cabin for about 7 years after graduating. Wow. And okay. I did have access to other humans, but I was living in a cabin on the land. And that was a time when I had a major reawakening into the depth of nature. So that sense of like, I get it. I get it. Because that actually began the real depth of the work that I do with people now as well in the rewilding.
Gotcha.
I understand that. And when you're speaking about this this place that it's not about the physical, it's actually, it's about partly, predominantly about the mental and what's happening in our mental place. Mm. In our normal society, there's a way that we're relating to reality, our connection, our disconnection that everyone is, well, many people are buying into. And there's something that happens, I believe, when we're rewilding, and I'm curious to hear on your part, when the rewilding is happening, what's happening to that status quo, or what I think of as when we've been domesticated and then we're becoming mm-hmm. undomesticated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I like a quote from the author, Derek Jensen. He said, When we're in a human-made environment, we can get away with believing strange things. Well, if everywhere we look, we see that which is the product of the human mind, we see these amazing skyscraper buildings, and we see these incredible fast cars, and we see these signs and things, we can start to believe strange things like the human mind is capable of controlling wild nature, or has dominion or some kind of entitlement over wild nature.
It might be its job, actually.
Exactly, yeah. This is what we need to keep doing. Yeah, yeah. And whatever environment we find ourselves in, we sort of subtly become invested in perpetuating that environment and protecting it and thinking up stories and reasons why it's supposed to be like this. I think that's just a natural part of the human mind. And what I noticed, and I notice every time I go into wild nature now, is there's an ego shift where my ego is used to being swollen up and plump. And in the modern world, everyone wants to know, what does your ego have to think about this? What's your ego's opinion on this? Can your ego write a report about that? And my ego loves, you know, I've got all these answers and all this authority and status. And then I go into wild nature and suddenly my ego is revealed to be quite small and not quite up to the task. And now I realize every time I set foot in wild nature, to thrive here, actually there's a receptivity that's necessary. And that receptivity is quite alien to my ego self. There's a receptivity where I have to look for the subtle signs, and I have to listen carefully, and I have to taste and touch and walk quietly and respectfully. And that inherently has a sort of a humbling effect on the ego. The ego says, okay, I don't really know what to do. I better be quiet. There's another part of this body system, this organism that knows what to do here. And an image I often use is the idea that maybe we could think of ourselves as sort of this creature nature that we have, this wonderful mammal. Sometimes I think about it as a monkey being ridden by a horse. I got this my horse body. I got this majestic mammal body that kind of knows what it needs. It knows when it's tired, and it knows when it needs to seek out food. But there's this monkey riding on top, holding onto the mane. And it, every time that the horse does something, the monkey tries to take credit for it. The horse says, we're hungry, we're going to go have some food. The monkey says, yes, of course, we're eating now, because that's what we need to do, because I need to get my macronutrients. And then the horse says, actually the horse doesn't say anything, because it's kind of subverbal most of the time. So the horse lies down for a rest. And the monkey says, yes, we're lying down for a rest now, because rest is extremely important because of X and Y and Z reasons. And sometimes the horse does things that the monkey finds very problematic and hard to explain. Like the horse will get up and say, starts moving into a vision quest experience, goes to spend 4 days on its own in the bush, or wants to go on a survival trip. And the monkey says, I think we're doing this. I'm not quite sure. I think it's going to help me be a better person. Yes. And I've read some spiritual literature about this. So it's trying to reassure itself that it's still in control. But really, this is an impulse that comes from this mammal body. There's a deep knowing, there's a deep yearning and calling, which I think doesn't come from words and from reason. And then the monkey starts to kind of fall apart. Then the monkey's like, I don't know how to explain this anymore, and starts to get very agitated and look for tiny little ways it can find control.
And so that what I'm hearing in that too is that it's one is my attention really wants to go towards, and so how do we support the horse or that part of our subconscious to be fully heard, expressed, present, right? So that would be where I go with the rewild. And then I'm also really aware that the monkey needs some attention so that it doesn't get in the way, right? So we're dealing with this thing. Yeah. And I'm wondering if could you play with that with us a little? Like, what does it mean to take care of the horse?
Yeah, beautiful question. Yeah. I think, you know, for me, the most common practice I like, which is sort of tending to the horse, grooming the horse, is body awareness. So maybe a body scan meditation, where I just take a chance to just take a breath and just check in. And I sort of remember my body, because the monkey forgets about the horse. The monkey likes to pretend it's just floating through space. And so I say, okay, here are my feet. These wonderful, strong feet that carry me. Here are these legs, these incredible strong legs that have been moving me through my life. This body with these mysterious and powerful organs that clean and replenish and revitalize and nourish me, and these arms and these clever hands, this beating heart that's been beating since before I was born, these even jaw muscles and discovering the muscles of the eyes and tongue and face. And okay, here I am back in my body again. This I think is inherently nourishing to the horse. Mm. And now I sort of have it, access to the internal guidance system of the horse too. These my yearnings, my longings, my sensitivity, the things that my body wants to move towards, the things that my body wants to move away from, the natural boundaries that my body knows it has. This is okay. This is not okay. And it's not a logical sense. This is just a feeling sense of this, that actually is a trespassing on some deeply held values of mine. Or this feels in alignment with some deeply held values of mine. This is the language of the horse, I think.
Hmm. And I can ask you this because I know you work as a psychotherapist, so it won't be too far out there, but I'm also curious, and then who is the I looking at both of these? And that's a place that I'm often in, and also working with my clients to distinguish.
Beautiful. Like,
what do we do with that part? Who is that?
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. And that's, yeah, I like to make that distinction too. We can look at ourselves as a monkey and as a horse and recognize ultimately we're neither of these, and that we have this mysterious, subtle, silent awareness that can hold the monkey in awareness and hold the horse in awareness too. And that in holding the both together, there's a kind of a fusion, there's a unity here. Now we can start to move as a single eye, rather than as a split eye, which can be at war with itself. As a central principle of my psychotherapy is, it's the awareness is the healing power. Mm-hmm. And when someone is in distress and they need some support, we could think about that as a failure of awareness, in the sense that my focus or my ability to focus my awareness isn't quite strong enough to keep from getting swept away in this experience and starting to believe strange stories like this experience is who I am, or that the world is no longer benevolent, or that I'm no longer able to get what I need from the world. And so then I think approach psychotherapy as the joining of awareness, the meeting in awareness. Your ability to focus is compromised in right now. I'm not able to focus, and we all go through experiences like this. We all are at times are overwhelmed. And it's much easier as humans to see with clarity what other people's problems, with our own problems. I don't know what the hell to do with this, but someone else, you tell me your problems, I know exactly what you need to do. That's easy. So it's this beautiful gift we can give to each other. I'll join my awareness with your awareness, and maybe together this will be enough for something interesting to emerge, to unfold, for healing to begin. Perhaps that's all we need to do. Yeah.
And just sort of dropping into that, as our listeners right now, my invitation is that this conversation with Lee is that you allow yourself not just to hear us from the outside, but to hear what we're saying from the inside. Like, what part of what we're saying can wake something up in you? Mm. Like, the invitation of all these conversations, but right now especially, is that we're identifying parts of self that may not have been in an active conversation with before. Or maybe you are, and like, I'm really thrilled if that's the case. But right now we get to honor this. Oh, we're putting some more things on the table. So when we're rewilding, part of what that is not just going off into the woods and being wild, but it's an internal process. Mm-hmm. And a process that I'm guessing you spent the year in the bush, you came back and living in society and figuring out ways then to keep that alive. Yes?
Yeah. And often failing at that. And I think a part of my process of coming back was actually supporting the monkey. And that a part of that felt like sort of dewilding a little bit in a necessary way. You know, at first, I was no longer able to do conversations with people. I was always a beat behind in the conversations, and I would realize, oh, I should have said something then, or that was when I was supposed to respond, but I was a bit too busy being overwhelmed by this whole situation to do it. And I think I just seemed a bit standoffish and a bit weird. And so part of it was supporting the monkey and giving the monkey some space and time to remember how to be a modern human again, and sort of to give it enough confidence again that it could actually feel a little bit of status and authority, being so thoroughly humbled, so thoroughly in the background. I think it'd forgotten how to use its voice in some ways. And you know, now what I say to the families on our camps who are regularly coming on these journeys with us, where we go from one world, this human-made world, into the wild world, and then back again. My prayer, I say, is for us to be at home in all the worlds. Can we be at home in all of the worlds? And then the more often that we cross over this threshold between worlds, the more fluid that journey becomes. But inherently, there's always a little bit of extra effort or a little bit of crunchiness, some grief, some overwhelm in both directions, I think. But that it's possible that this is how it's supposed to be, that in some way we're kind of weaving the worlds back together again. Every time we move from one world to another, we're making that pathway a little bit more well-trodden, a little bit more familiar, a little bit more known. And that's how we're making a bridge between the worlds. And it makes room for other people to be able to traverse the worlds, because there are a richness and beauty in both of them, I think.
Mm. And an incredible beauty in being able to go back and forth. Right.
Yes.
That it is, you know, it's part of, like, I live amongst people now, and I know that part of my work is to help, as it seems yours, to help with that translation or the support of being able to move back and forth, so that the expansion of both areas, and I don't just think it's both, I think it's multiple, but for simplicity of this conversation, I'll say both areas, gets to be fully felt, sensed, expressed, and these two parts get to inform each other.
Which I think they do so much. Hey, when I came out of that year in the bush, my God, running hot water. How sacred.
Still one of my favorite things.
Supermarkets. Yeah, that's absolutely, that's the height of civilization.
I have heard you say there's the principle that life is always working for us, whether it feels like it is or it isn't. How does that tie in with this? Because I feel like it's an under thread running through all of your work.
This principle, life is always working with us and for us, whether we know it or not. Mm-hmm. And sometimes whether we like it or not. This kind of, I think about it as assumption of goodwill. We assume goodwill on the part of life, assume goodwill on the part of the universe, because it's very easy. One of the first stories that the monkey clings to in times of stress is this victimhood story, this feeling of it would be okay except for this person who's being unacceptable, or the way the world is, which is unacceptable, or these people who are attacking me, or being this situation is just becoming an obstacle for me. We very quickly, the monkey finds itself in the position of victim if it's not getting what it needs quickly. And that's just problematic on its own, because now we have this confirmation bias that goes on in our mind, and we see more evidence that supports this story that things are inherently wrong in the world, and maybe there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with others. And now I'm only seeing evidence which supports that. And so to open up the possibility for change and growth, one of my fundamentally held principles is just the ultimate benevolence of life. That actually there is an intelligence, there's a generosity, there's a compassion even to life itself. And if we can't find that, if we can't, you know, I remember that being offered this by a mentor, and at the time I was thinking, how can you say this? Look at the world, look at the state of the world, the horrible oppression and suffering and wrongness and injustice. How can you say this? And he said something which took a while for me to really hear properly. He said, well, we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. Mm. And I said, well, that's easy for you to say as an older privileged white male. I'm a younger person trying to grow up in this world. and it's, you know, this isn't to minimize the suffering in the world, which is very real for the people who are going through it. And when we're going through it, and we all move in and out of this, but I think for real transformation and growth and healing, we have to at least entertain the possibility that there is a different perspective on the world, where the wrongness and the imbalance and the terrible horror that we see in the world is some kind of a movement on its way to something else. It's not the end of the story. This is act two of the story. of a three-act story, and it's going to find its resolution in the third act, but we are moving towards that. If we can trust the arc, if we can trust that there's something better, that there's some progress that's being made, in the same way that if we happen to come into a woman laboring, a woman giving birth in a room, if we go into this room and we didn't know about the third act of where this is heading, we would just see pain, suffering, distress, terror. And we would say, my God, a horror is unfolding in front of us. Mm-hmm. But then as those of us who know what comes after and what the resolution is, hopefully most of the time, then we know that there's somewhere that we can end up, that we can have faith in, that we can look forward to.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing in that also is that this is something that we can take on, like whether or not it's the ultimate truth, that there's a way that holding it as a perspective actually enhances the experience of life. And so just as we get to take on, society says for us to be upset and to hold a grudge and to point fingers, like we're being told or taught or raised to believe that as a context. And so what I'm hearing is you're bringing this in as an equally viable context.
Yeah.
Right? Is that?
Yeah, it's actually, it's just practical. It's sort of like, why don't I take this story on as a working hypothesis and let my confirmation bias start to look for possibilities, start to look for opportunities, start to look for ways in which it might be true that actually there's an intelligence guiding this, there's a benevolence here, and that these difficulties, these struggles that I'm moving through, they might be some kind of a contraction, some kind of birthing pain for something larger and more beautiful to come.
One of the things that always amazes me is when I am in an experience of lack of time, lack of resources, lack of, you know, and I can get there like this, like, oh, I don't have enough time to do everything I need to do. Mm-hmm. And there's so too much expected of me. And I go for a walk. If I go out into what your equivalent of the bush is my jungle, if I go out into the jungle, I am struck by how there is no end of abundance and creativity and destruction and creation and evolution. And when I can be in that space and let the monkey take the background and we'll just, you know, and the horse can lie down in the trail, there's a sense exactly, you know, really of what you're saying, that there's so much more at play.
Yeah.
There's so much more at play. And I'm only seeing the lack and not, and, you know, not, I'm looking at, you know, the dead grass is not the mulch that's coming from that, that's going to allow the next thing to grow.
Yeah, beautiful. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The monkey's really good at focusing in on details. Hey, monkeys look for fleas and nits to pick and things, but the horse has these eyes on either side of the head. Horse can see what's behind and in front. There's this sort of a broader context, which I think is inherently therapeutic. If we can locate ourselves in a larger circle than just this little circle of just tiny little individual me, or this broader circle of life. If it's okay, as you were talking, I reminded me of this time years ago when I had a daughter who died, my 3-year-old daughter. And the very morning that we walked out of the hospital, after she'd passed, we'd spent the night, my then wife, we'd spent the night with her body, and we walked out into the morning sunlight, and we see people trying to go about their lives, and I'm sort of in this kind of shock place at the moment. It hasn't really sort of landed, but as we sat down at a cafe, we thought, let's try and tend to the horse, let's eat some food, and this kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, a flutter or a flock of moths came through this cafe, in an outdoor cafe, and these tiny little moths, maybe just hatched or something, in the middle of the day or in bright sunlight, they sort of get blown by a breeze into this cafe seating area, and they're in people's hair and they're falling into drinks, and I see people plucking them out, and it's just, so they're sort of crushing them and then throwing them away, or they're pulling them out of their hair and destroying these little moths. And I think the thought I had was, my God, how is it possible to live in this world where all life is being snuffed out continuously? And I was seeing it happen. And I in that moment, I was like, every single one of these moths is someone's daughter, someone's son. How can I live in this world where this kind of thing is happening? And as I sort of asked that question, it's like I really genuinely asked the question. I like a pebble dropped into a pond. I felt the ripples of it spread through my body. And then this other ripple came back again. And it was this feeling of that very kinship that I felt with the moths. These are all someone's sons, someone's daughters. There was a grace in that. There was a kind of a salvation in that in that sense that, oh, I'm seeing bereaved. There are bereaved parents everywhere in some sense. You know, you look in the natural world, there are trees that have fallen down. That was someone's offspring. And that took me into that larger perspective, this kind of this zooming out, this wider context of a sense of, you know, little waves of life coming and then crashing and then emerging and then moving back again into the sea of existence, and all of them someone's son, all of them someone's daughter. There's a kind of a connection, this kind of kindred breaking open of the heart in that moment. I was like, this, she came into my life and she broke my heart open to life, was the thought that popped in. And now I have this kindred connection with all of the other parents who have loved and lost, or all of the other humans who have held something dearly, cherished it, and then had to let that go. That experience was a gift that really has empowered me to do a lot of the work that I do. And but it came from this broadening of perspective, this wider circle, this locating myself in life rather than locating myself as this person, the bereaved parent, or this person, the struggling human. Yeah.
Mm. First of all, thank you for that story.
Thank you.
My heart is feeling for you. And just wanting to just take that moment, because this is an experience I just want to offer for everybody who's present to this, that our common way to be with this would be rush on to the next thing. And I want us all to just feel whatever we're feeling in this moment, that this animal body gets to experience what just came up. Like for me, there's a feeling of sadness and I feel it washing through. And I just want to name that, because I believe that the more we're present to what we're experiencing, more actually in life, in the living of life, we get to be, versus compartmentalizing and locking something down. Mm. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm. And that experience of being in life, from the bigger perspective, and I also want to say, and then bringing it back right now to this moment of sitting here, of being in life.
Hello.
I'm glad this thread came up, and I think it's, you know, it's one I didn't expect to come up in our conversation today, but I'll just, I'm going to just be with it, is that I myself have had a lot of loss in my life, and those people who are close to me know that. And so storytelling comes in now, right? You're telling a story, and I just want to put out one of the things that Lee is really graced and gifted with is telling stories, and not necessarily that's what you're trying to do here, but that when we tell a story to someone else without necessarily expecting from them that they're going to fix it or help us or change it, but actually sharing the story in the way you are, it offers the listener, it offers me, it offers the village something different. And I wonder if you're willing to take that thread, because I'm guessing this is not the first time you've told this story. And this is probably a story that many people, if they had this in their back pocket, they might not share with anyone. And yet you're choosing to share it right now with thousands and thousands of people, I believe, from not a place so that we all feel sorry for you, but for some other reason, multiple reasons.
I think it's one of our superpowers. Hey, this sharing of experience, this ability to share experience, and that movement that John often talks about, John Young, that this ancient movement of humans leaving our camp, leaving the sphere of the human, moving out into wild nature as hunter-gatherers, having our adventures, our experiences, our successes and our losses. And then we come back together again at the end of the day and we sit around the campfire and we share the stories. We collect the experiences, and it's almost like we relive the experiences of others. We weren't there, but when I hear you tell that, and and someone is actually living this story in front of us, our mirror neurons light up, and there was some part of me actually got to experience that. And so as a whole, as a tribe, as a culture, we are enriched and we grow and we collect these kind of structures of compassion and wisdom is how I think about stories. You know, really a story is compassion and wisdom encoded into characters and events, but it's really compassion and wisdom is there. And we can, it's so powerful. We can sit in a room and read novels, but we know from the novels what it's like to be a pirate or to be a lover deeply in love or someone in space or, you know, the different tragedies and successes and triumphs. And we know from fairy tales, not that dragons exist, but that it's possible to vanquish dragons, as Neil Gaiman says. That's the power of stories. And one of the ways I think about, I make sense of my existence is my job as a person is to go out into the world, inhabit this incredible mammal body with its yearning heart, with this anxieties and beliefs, and have that all be tested. Have that all sort of all meeting life in all of the different ways it wants to meet life, and life wants to meet me. And then my job is to share about how that was for me. And perhaps that's the job of all of us, to share how that was for us, because we all are facets of this many-faceted jewel of truth. We all of us are here to say, this is how it is for me in this experience and this perspective. And anytime there's a real transmission here and it's shared, as you say, in that generous way, we're all so enriched. We say, okay, aha, this is now I feel a closer connection to this interesting and many-faceted experience that we call life now, because I see it through your eyes as well as mine.
And there's something really different about the experience. And I'd just love for our audience right now to just get this beautiful, yeah, we're on a screen. But did you all just feel that? I just felt that. Yeah. I'll just feel that. This realness of when we show up, not trying to move anywhere beyond where we are in the moment of the unfolding. And Lee, in this place of telling the story, offering the story like this, there's something really different, I think, that's happening with screen time and being in computer tech and all of those, and not to make one thing bad or not, but would you just mind giving us a little bit of your perspective, especially on children and their experience of that, in whatever way you want to, just for the parents who are out there who are like, oh, I don't get to tell stories to my kid, but they have a device and they get time with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge can of worms, hey, and I
want to preface.
I appreciate
I'm not
you.
Wanting to throw you under the bus. I'm actually just wanting we get your perspective. And I've seen, I know that you teach parents about being in nature, and I also know we're living in a world in which, you know, my beloved nephews spend a lot of time with their little devices.
Yeah,
and it's like, and they live in the woods and they have devices, like. How do we make sense of that? So I'm not asking you to have the only answer, but I'm curious perspective, what you see.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think I it's a can of worms, because I never want to give parents any other reason to beat themselves over the head with a stick of judgment. We have so many reasons already, and so much in our culture sort of invites us to do that. So recognizing, as you say, I think the children who are here in the world now, my belief is they came to be born into this world. It's not an accident that they found themselves in this world at this particular time, and so and everything that goes along with that for them. And so we're all finding our way. We're all kind of asking this question: how much is okay? How much is too much? And we it's can be amazingly useful and wonderful. We get to connect like this across continents and oceans.
Thousands of us get this moment together.
And then, you know, for me, I We try to limit it as much in our household as possible. I try to emphasize audio stories because I think that there is, I see there's a different interaction with audio stories versus video. And when my daughter, I have a five-year-old, she's listening to the audio stories, I see her gazing off into the middle distance and her imagination is there. It's playing out these stories for her. And I'm slightly biased because I grew up in the 80s with story cassettes, and I had a little player that would rewind it, and I love that. That was incredible for me. I think it was a big part of me learning about the power of stories and being really held. It felt like such a loving thing to have these incredible voice actors hold me in their voice in those worlds. So we do audio as much as possible, and still, I love, it's great to be able to, my sister lives in the French Alps, and I love being able to say to my Australian daughter, who's never seen snow before, hey, this is what the French Alps looks like. And we'll go on a little journey and I'll show you some video of this is your auntie skiing. And these are the goats and the marmots and the wolves that live up in those mountains. We can traverse those landscapes together. I'm always sort of trying to see how can we use it in a way that augments her imagination, augments her curiosity rather than floods and fills and allows her curiosity or her imagination to atrophy. I think it's possible.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's possible too, especially when we're conscious around it. And yet I'm also really grateful I grew up without a lot of that. So my finding of it has been as more of an adult, I found finding my way and picking and choosing. And I really wonder about the younger generations who are, especially if their parents don't necessarily get them out in nature enough to find experience of what it is like to really drop in. Because my experience is that it takes time to actually be in nature and allow the noise to drop away.
Yeah, true. And on our camps, it makes me think, on our family camps, we have this incredible blessing. There's absolutely no cell reception at all. No Wi-Fi, no mobile reception. And so we get often quite heavily screen addicted kids who are, that's absolutely their comfort zone. And then it takes, for me, I think, 24 to 48 hours when they start to realize, oh, this is a group of people where I can feel safe, where I can feel some belonging, where there are interesting things happening. There are adventures going on, and there's information and wisdom that I'd like, that this magic about how to make fire or how to build a waterproof house in the woods. And we hear them say things like, oh, this is actually even better than iPads. where I come to is I think actually we're hardwired to be addicted to a life that works. We're compelled to find a life that works, where we can feel a life where we can feel safe, where we can feel connected to a wider community, where we can feel connected to nature, where there's meaningful challenges, meaningful growth and learning that's going on. And I think when kids experience that, anyone experiences that, addictions naturally fall away. It's like, okay, actually, I don't need that dopamine hit now, because that dopamine hit was a substitute for something else that I might not have even tasted before. But now, finding myself in wild nature, in this safe and healthy human community where I feel like I belong, there's a deep surging wave of all kinds of wonderful things going on, which includes dopamine. And now I realize, I actually, that the prospect of going back to an iPad feels somewhat lonely or limiting even.
And that causes me to want to pull a thread, and it's a question that I've been asking all of the speakers, which I have a feeling you'll unpack in a slightly different way, which I love. And the question being, the title of this is Wild and Awake. Mm-hmm. How do we live our best lives right now? And so when you hear that, what comes up for you? What's your experience? And there's not a right answer, obviously. We're just looking through our lenses.
I think for me, I often find myself asking myself this question. And I notice often when I do that, what I reach for when I think about my best life is this projection of how I kind of should be. Shoulda, woulda, coulda is how it looks like. And I sort of feel myself drawn towards this. Maybe if I was just doing X or Y or Z a bit more differently. And then very often what sneaks in through the back door is some judgment about maybe I should just be pulling myself up by the bootstraps a bit more. I should just be trying harder. I should just be pushing myself a bit harder. And I often find myself in a place where now actually it doesn't feel like there's as much compassion for myself now as there was previously. And that somewhere along the way, my aspirations and my yearning and my deepest values have somehow become the stick which I'm beating myself over the head with. And it's just, it's a sneaky and slippery thing.
That stick, right?
Yeah. So for me, I think the practice is sort of balancing these cherished and sacred images that I hold, my yearnings. This is what I came here to be. This is what I came here to do. I see my best life, and there's an aliveness and electricity about that for me. And then along the way, perhaps me being exactly where I am right now, perhaps this is another version of my best life. This is one way I can experience my best life being on the way to that beautiful image. And perhaps in some respects, whether I even reach it or not is not as important as whether I'm fully, as you say, inhabiting this now life, which is maybe if I look at it in terms of the act two, my progress towards the act three, this journey, this sacred journey where, yeah, things don't always go right. And often there's frustration and maybe I'm not doing the work I need to be doing right now, or I'm not exactly where I want to be right now, but I am living it to the fullest of my ability. I am collecting stories along the way which I can share, and there's richness in that. Hey, this has been difficult for me. If I share this with you, maybe there's a connection and a beauty and an alchemy that happens now when we say, oh, I hear that. And now I realize it's not just me failing at life or struggling alone in my human skin, but there's something inherent about this existence that requires for growth to happen. Suffering happens too. Just like this mother giving birth to a baby, it's not supposed to be completely fluid and easy all the time. Sometimes it is, but other times there are all kinds of things that happen along the way, and that they actually, in the context of growth and learning and healing, can become sacred, can become part of this vision of best. Yeah.
Thank you, Lee. I actually have to say, in choosing the title of this, it was because it's a question I ask myself a lot. And I think it's a question under the surface that people are asking in a different way. There's a lot of what I hear energetically as a statement out there, which is, I'm not doing my life right. I'm doing something wrong. Gotcha. I'm not doing my life right. I'm doing something wrong. Like that, almost sort of like the mantra.
Yeah,
okay. Modern civilization. And so I just wanted to shine a big light on it and say, what happens when we actually look at it directly and say, what would it mean to be actually living this life, the best life right now? Mm-hmm. If what we're presupposing is that we're not.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Because that undercurrent of what I feel energetically society is saying over and over again to us is part of why we have so much depression and discontent and suffering, at least in the context that I see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Life is supposed to be different than it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah. No, that's interesting. I see that. An image that springs to my mind hearing that, and that experience of I'm doing it wrong, I'm getting it wrong somehow, which I think to me resonates with a lot of times in my life, and especially that time in the bush where I thought I was getting it wrong somehow. I love the image of, this is a teaching story from Tom Brown, who's one of my mentors and John Young's mentors. His teacher was doing some flint knappings, making a stone tool. And this particular rock was refusing to break. So he was having to strike it a few times. And none of the strikes were actually cracking it until the sixth or seventh turn, finally it broke open. And his teacher turned to Tom and he said, which strike broke the rock? And Tom's first response was, it was that sixth or seventh one. And his teacher said, actually, it was all of them. And, you know, which contraction gives birth to the baby? If we think we're just supposed to do it in one go, then we just spend a lot of time thinking we're failing.
That's painful.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it might be a violence to that even. Yeah, so perhaps perhaps it's almost as though we have to butt up against this feeling of wrongness, this all of the different ways in which it's not quite right. And as we do that, we get more and more clarity, more and more wisdom. Our character is being formed with more and more strength and certainty until finally, like a river that's been dammed and it starts to build up by a tree that's fallen across it. We're gathering enough momentum, gathering enough volume of water that we can surge ahead at some point. And we sweep these obstacles out of our path. And now we're a surging river rather than just that trickling stream that we were before. But there's a process to it. There's a three-act structure. There's the problem and then the building of something and then the release. But that happens in tipping points. If we don't know about this idea of tipping points and how it can look like not much is happening. Maybe I'm failing. Maybe I'm not where I'm supposed to be. I'm going around in circles. But really, I was spiraling deeper and deeper and deeper until warm. Then the moment came.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'd like to just circle back a little that being able to feel in the process of it, that whether it's like hitting the flint or whether it's the river, to that experience is going back to the rewilding, like allowing my horse to be present versus just the monkey. Because the monkey
exactly.
is done or
monkey's like
show.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. We should have ticked this off the to-do list already. The horse understands about processes. Yeah.
There's a term that I know you use in your work that I'd love for you to just unpack a little bit, which is the default mode network. Would you just put that out there? Because I think that helps a little bit with what we're talking about and maybe useful for folks.
Nice. Yeah. So this default mode network. It's a part of the brain or several areas of the brain that was discovered in the 90s when we first had the technology to start looking at what was going on in the brain in real time. And experimenters would give participants a challenge. They would say, do this maze or figure out this problem and we'll see what's going on in your brain. And then in between the challenges, in between the activities, they would say, just relax for a second while we set up the next challenge for you to do. And then they would look at the screen sometimes and big areas of the brains would be lighting up, much more activity suddenly than what was going on during them figuring out this problem. And then they would say, well, just relax, calm down, what are you doing? We said don't do anything. And always the participant would say, I wasn't doing much of anything. I was just kind of thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner tonight, or I was thinking about what so-and-so said to me last week. And so what they started to realize was this: when there's nothing in particular that we need to do, the brain seems to focus internally and starts to weave together this sense of who I am and where I'm going, a storytelling process, really, weaving together things that have happened in the past and my expectations and hopes for the future. And weaving these two together, these mental constructs of the past, stories about the past, stories about the future, weaving them together into a sense of I. And that maybe even in some sense, this is the ego. Kind of the ego spider weaving its web in real time. This is how I start. I tell myself the story of who I am and how the world is. All things being equal, I'll do that. If I've got nothing else to do, that's what I start to do. And that's kind of what we do, right? When we're driving along or we're just kind of waiting for something. They call it the default mode network because it seems to be the default mode. It's our default mode that we go into is telling ourselves that story. And that's fine and lovely. And it's useful to have an ego in the world. We need to know who we are and how the world is. And we need to piece together a coherent narrative so we can make sense of our lives. But when things get difficult in our lives, when we're trying to live a life that isn't really working for us, there's one or more of our needs that aren't really being met. My work doesn't feel meaningful. Or I'm not feeling safe in my relationship or in my life for some reason. Or I've got some trauma has been flushed up. There's some echoes of the past that actually are a bit too intense and distressing for this to be easily woven together into a coherent narrative. Instead, it's feeling like the spider's having some holes torn in the web, even while it's trying to weave it. Then what can happen is the spider gets a bit more frenetic and starts rushing around in a kind of compelled, impulsive way, trying to tell itself a story of how I can make sense of how this has happened and who I am. And then at that point, the stories can get a bit poisonous. They can get a bit toxic. We might find ourselves telling ourselves stories that about ourselves that there's something wrong with me, or that I messed up in some way that I really shouldn't have done, or that there's something I could be doing if only I was a bit more courageous or intelligent or charismatic or rich or something like that. Or we start telling ourselves toxic stories about the world, that there's something inherently unfair about the world or unjust or scarce or dangerous. And So the default mode network, we need to know about this whenever we're going through difficult periods of our lives, because it exacerbates whatever problems that we have going on. You know, in Buddhism, they talk about the second arrow. The first arrow is whatever injustice or insult or suffering life deals us. The second arrow is where the default mode network or the monkey, you know, we could kind of think about them as pretty similar. There's some overlap there. Starts dealing us the second arrow. The second arrow says, yes, this thing has happened and it's your fault, or, and it's always going to be this way, or, and this is just typical of how things are in life in general. And we can see, you know, those are how we attribute, how we make meaning of the painful and difficult things that happen to us, really make a big difference in how we respond and how quickly we're able to move through and beyond and progress past our setbacks and our pains. So the default mode network is a big part of the conversations I have with my clients. And we're very often seeing, can we just, first of all, bring more awareness into the default mode network? Can we just notice what's going on? Notice those moments when, my gosh, actually, when I think about it, several moments during the day when 5 or 10 minutes go past where I'm just doing head miles, having a go at myself, or shouting at someone in my head, or catastrophizing in my mind about all the terrible things that could go wrong or have gone wrong in the past, and realizing how exhausting that is actually, and how painful it is, how it's kind of a hole in our bucket that where our life force and our motivation, our self-esteem is leaking out. So can we stop the self-harm first? Or can we at least bring awareness to that first so we can really see the full cost and nature of that? And then we can start to introduce what some larger and more spacious and more compassionate stories might be. Can we reframe and make meaning in a new light that's going to be more empowering, more inspiring? Yeah.
And I love that image of the spider rushing around trying to like mend the holes, because I'm sure many of us get that image. Yeah. What that feels like, and just to have a name for it. So I appreciate you unpacking it so fully, because here we are in this modern world doing, running around, trying to be so many different things. And just, I believe that having some languaging around our own relationship to ourselves, so that compassionate part of ourselves can look at ourselves and say, hey, sweetie, this is what you're doing right now. There's a name for it. And it makes sense that you're doing this. This is actually an old way that we would historically have taken care of ourselves, is to create a story to make sense of things.
Exactly.
But the story might, maybe can be told a different way.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, exactly. It's just what happens when an organism is put under enough pressure and the storytelling mechanism goes a bit sproing, comes off the rails a little bit. And then it can become kind of self-enforcing and self-perpetuating. And I think it's another reason why wild nature is so important, because inside a house, it's very easy on our own for the default mode network to have a lot of airtime.
Yes.
But then the minute, as you say, when we're in wild nature, now everywhere we look, interesting and new and fresh things are taking our attention. And the key, one of the key ways of reestablishing balance with the default mode network is finding ways to get my attention outside of myself. When it's focused inside, then I can do the head miles. I start to smell burning rubber as the wheels are spinning. But when I find ways, and some are just being in wild nature. Now I'm continually hearing birdsong. I'm feeling these interesting breezes on my skin and these new smells and this insect over here. Or why is that tree growing in that particular way? And now my attention is being drawn outward in a way that's just inherently therapeutic and actually necessary for deep health, I think.
I love that. I love that image. And I'm aware we're going to need to wrap up soon. However, what I love is if just in that last little bit, you were offering a way that we could actually experience ourselves unhooking a little bit, or rewilding a little bit, or being out a little bit. And you're just explaining what it, you know, taking in a few more senses. But would you actually offer it to us in a way that somebody could say, I have a tool right now. I'm going to go out on this little tiny mini adventure because I just heard this really cool guy talk and I'm going to see if something different happens for me.
A mini adventure is a lovely way to describe it, because I think the even the word adventure, the prospect of adventure,
adventures.
Adventures, huh? Because I think so often in our lives, when the default mode network has got its hooks in, it has all the answers. You know, the monkey would rather have all the answers and have them be terrible, toxic, imprisoning answers than have to deal with the reality that we actually just don't know. I don't know how this situation is going to resolve itself. I don't know how I'm going to move forwards in the future. I don't know how my efforts are going to be met. My efforts at communication or connection or creativity, I don't know what reception they're going to have. There's a mystery that's inherent there. And so adventure is a nice way to sort of bring back mystery and unknowing into our lives in a fun way. And so, yeah, a practice I love, Tom Brown, he calls it wandering without time or destination. Wondering without no time, no destination. The default mode network deals in time. It's always trying to pull us thin between our past and our future. We get stretched out along this timeline. And then if we say there's no time here now, and we can set that in practical terms, we might sort of set a timer on our watch or on our device, and then we put it away. So we don't have to think about it. But within this half an hour that I have, an hour, maybe even just 10 minutes, no time. I'll let the device do the timekeeping so I don't have to. And then my job is just to wander without time or destination. Where do I wander? How do I know how to wander? Well, I start to ask the horse. I say, where is my body guided to at the moment? What am I drawn towards? I'm drawn towards this tree. Maybe even as I'm being drawn towards this tree, I notice an interesting plant over there or a bird that's calling. And as I'm moving towards the tree, now I realize, okay, actually, this is where my body's being drawn towards. And then even as I'm being drawn towards that, maybe something else draws me somewhere else, so that I'm not thinking in terms of linear schedules and destiny. This is where I'm going to. I'm going towards. There's some spaciousness in going towards.
Right. And it's being in it. Being in it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm letting the horse have the reins in a way. Like horse, where if we didn't have time, if there was no destination, what would you feel drawn towards? And along the way, we get to lose our minds, lose the default mode network. We get to sort of come out of this being stretched across time, and we get to come into the present moment, lose our mind and come back into our senses. Mm-hmm. Losing our minds and coming into our senses. That's one of John Young's beautiful phrases. We start to, what the temperature of the air on the skin, the smells the beauty that I start to appreciate, because beauty is also something that's kind of transcendent. It's not something that the monkey really knows much about, but the horse can feel these qualities of beauty, these qualities of intelligence that we see, the intelligence behind this plant growing towards the light, the intelligence and the healing and transcendence that comes from this fallen tree that's now giving birth to new life, even as it rots and decays. And we start to be able to see these things, not in a verbal sense, but we see them just with that kind of instant realization and clarity that comes when we are living life freshly in the moment, in this with this quality of wildness that happens when we step outside of this monkey mind.
I think of it as the felt sensed.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Thank you for all the layers of this conversation today. This has been a real rich, tender, deep layered journey. And really appreciate your willingness to take us to all these different places.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated your holding and guiding in this conversation and in the work that you do. So yeah, thank you for creating this.
For people who want to find you, find your work, find out more about you, what's the best way to find you?
So you can have a look at my website, connectionculture.life. And I think we're also going to send out a link to an app which has the rapport-based relating training course, the first module of which is free. It includes diving deep into the default mode network and how to create healthy connections in family and relationships, how to get good clarity inside, and how to do communication, difficult conversations well. As well as sort of looking more broadly at connection and cultural repair as a spiritual practice, as a sort of a deeply meaningful way that we can participate in this business of life. The app and the website.
Yeah. A generous gift. Thank you. And I will say that's actually part of how I discovered these work and really digging in was this first piece of your course, and just really loved the depth of it. And so for the folks who are in this event, there'll be an app, so sign up, be able to get this free off the app itself, but also encourage you to go to Lee's website and put yourself on his mailing list so that you can follow what he's doing, because yeah. he's somebody to keep connected with in terms of the unfolding of his work. It's just a place that I encourage you to keep your heart space open for what this man is putting out there in the world, because there's some really beautiful layers.
Thanks, Kari. Yeah.
And for our audience today, I want to thank all of you for being here, for being in the space of opening your minds and your curiosity, being able to hold new ideas that you maybe haven't thought of before and in a new context, and being willing to shift and change and grow as you're ready to. And this is the space that we're holding right now in this in this question of being more wild and awake. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you, Kari. Yeah.